is nigh. A cataclysm is coming, and Azeroth will never be the same again. This is a final voyage through the old world. And these are the many wonders you'll see.
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Postcards from the Old World, one last tour around Azeroth before it's all changed forever in the upcoming cataclysm. I'm your host Gaffoni and I'm here with my co-host Arezzo.
Hello there, and this time we're going to be talking about Silverpine Forest, the Ghostlands, and everybody's favourite, the Barons.
Ah, the Barons. Yes, this is all the level 10 to 20 stuff on the Horde side, which we'll be looking over before we finally break out into the wider world at large next show. We've been having a lot of fun with levelling, a lot of fun, actually, discovering new places, looking at new things that we've honestly never seen before, so I think we're agreed that this is actually, just for us, just selfishly, quite an interesting project.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like as you say, that even though we've been around the world a number of times on a number of characters, there's just odd little things that we're just coming across that I think are taking us both by surprise, which is really cool.
Yep, and that's all thanks to you pointing out the places and the things we need to see as we go along on the forums. As ever, there'll be a thread for the next show, which we'll discuss at the end. And throughout this show, we'll be incorporating your comments on the zones as we tour them.
So, without further ado, why don't we crack on and get started with a quick look at Silverpine Forest.
The woodlands west of Lordaeron are shrouded in mystery and magic. The Archmage Arugal spreads his influence across the region from his fortified base of Shadowfang Keep in the south, close to the border with the walled-off territory of Gilneas, and the effects of that land's Worgen curse are felt throughout the forest. Pyrewood Village is a particular danger to travelers at night, but all of the woods should be traveled with care. One of the more striking natural features in the area is Lordaemir Lake, in the middle of which Fenris Keep provides striking views across the lake for those who negotiate the hostile Noel tribe, which now control Fenris Isle.
Silverpine is, of course, generally the first zone you'll go to after Tirith's Fall Glades if you're an undead. And from the comments on the forums, we had one that kind of summed the whole thing up from Caboose, who said, "Silverpine, although controlled by the Forsaken, is full of diversity and battle. With the undead plague and the lycanthropic curse of Gilneas, you see a land stripped of its former glory," which we thought summed it up really well. To be honest, it's one of my favourite zones. It wasn't everyone's favourite, but we'll come to that in a minute. But I really, really like it. We took some first impressions as we went through, and we agreed it felt a bit more open, a bit more airy than Tirith's Fall, which is a very gloomy zone. But Silverpine's got the big open body of water in it. It's got the coastline not far away. But I just love it. One of the things I particularly love about it is all the trees, all the trunks on the trees look like they've been bitten and chewed at and clawed at by animals, and one would guess that that's the Worgen running loose everywhere.
Yeah, I think that sense of openness and the coming from Tirith's Fall especially, that first thing that struck me was, you know, you're coming down that road, everything opens up. There is the big lake is right there beside you, and it's kind of, you know, big and open, and there's a big view, kind of vista down to the shore and the murlocs and stuff like that, which just makes it feel completely different when you first come to it from Tirith's Fall, which I really appreciated, because much as I like Tirith's Fall, it does get a bit oppressive after a while.
Yeah, but it also, in the same way that Tirith's Fall has obviously been ravaged by the plague, it's clear that Silverpine has as well, but you get a much more immediate feeling of that, because as you walk up that road from outside Undercity all the way through to the Sepulchre, the kind of Horde town, in Silverpine, you can see just from the side of the road a number of ruined farmhouses. And yes, fair enough, they're dotted all around Tirisfal, but you kind of have to go out of the way to find them. Whereas here, it's the sense of devastation, the sense of loss, is really right up there in your face.
Yeah, and also, I think one of the things that we both felt about the zone was that, you know, there's more of a sense of stuff going on, more variety, more feeling that as you explore the place, you're really opening up some new areas and some new experiences, which weren't really the case when you were running around in Tirisfal. So that definitely started to contribute to that sense that, you know, we're moving through as we get into different zones of really starting to explore a whole world.
And absolutely, with hindsight, you're introduced here to two pretty important factions, not in the strict game sense of factions, but you meet the Dalaran Wizards for the first time. You meet the Worgen for the first time. And you're starting to get the sense now of a bigger world that you're a part of.
Yeah. And I think especially now that we know that things like the Worgen are going to become a playable race, you know, that whole sense of what is going to change in Cataclysm, even though physically this might not be one of the zones that's going to change in a major way, the impact of what's just across the border in Gilneas is fairly significant.
Ah, oh, Gilneas. Not long now. Well, hopefully long enough for us to finish this show on schedule. But yeah, we'll find out what's behind that wall soon. Would you like to go through what some of the people said in the forum?
Absolutely. We already heard what Caboose said, but the first thing I'm going to look at is a comment that OMF made, which I can sympathise with and I definitely think has... will probably create sympathy in listeners as well. His comment is, ugh, no. Silverpine Forest is an example of an absolutely awful zone design that is far too prevalent in the old world. Basically, you take a long road, build a zone entirely around it and make the terrain horrifyingly uneven so that you basically cannot get anywhere unless you take the main road, which is true. I mean, it's a long, narrow north to south zone, and he mentioned a couple of other examples that work the same way, but actually the one that struck me straight away was one he didn't mention, which is Dustwallow Marsh, which is the big curving road that it's practically impossible to get around any other way. But anyway, as far as this zone's concerned, it definitely is a feature, and it is a big zone. It is quite difficult to move around apart from on the road, but then there is an awful lot of interesting stuff not far off the road, so that's a help.
I just wanted to pick up on that point. I don't think in this show we're going to be talking too much about what we know is going to change. But on the day we sat down to record this, MMO Champion got their hands on a ton of spoilers from the Cataclysm Alpha. So we kind of having a little peek at a few things there. And you mentioned Duskwallow, and Blizzard have seen the issue with this one road through and nothing else, because there's going to be a whole new big road in there. Also, we don't want to talk about it too much just in case people don't want spoilers. So rest assured, we're never, ever going to go into great detail about any of these things that are coming out about the Alpha or the Beta. But I think it's a good point, particularly with Silverpine, because there is one crucial point where there is a kind of stream at the bottom of a very steep, or very short, but a very steep valley. And there's a bridge on the road that goes over that stream. If you try and get over that valley without going over the bridge, you're out of luck. I think there's one fallen tree which requires a bit of crafty jumping to actually get on it to get over. Your only choice, really, is the road. And I can see what OMF is saying here about, you know, it's narrowing your choice. You know, this is your one way through the zone. And of course, it's way more fun to explore somewhere widely. I mean, look at the Barrens, which we'll come to later in the show, that you can just walk for miles, literally miles and miles, in any direction, whereas something like Silverpine kind of bottlenecks you a bit. I think for this zone, it's only that point. And I think there are far more exaggerated examples of this weak zone design in the game than Silverpine. Fellwood, I know that when we get around to talking about Fellwood in a later show, we'll have a lot to say about the shape of that zone and what it means for leveling there. And I hope to God that somehow the Cataclysm will just twist it into one big circle or something, because as it stands, it's not great. But as far as Silverpine goes, apart from that one bit, I don't mind it that much, because the zone kind of balloons out at either point from that bridge, north and south. So there are plenty of places to go off the beaten track and explore, which I think is one of the greatest things about a game like this.
Yeah, and there is plenty to explore, and you get to the lake really quickly, you get across the lake to the island really quickly, you can get out to the coast, as you said, at a couple of points, so it's, you know, there's an awful lot to get to that don't necessarily require you to follow the road, but yeah, sometimes you do certainly find yourself facing an insurmountable hill or cliff to get you where you want to go. Moving on to a couple of other comments, Hartman, in fact, picking up on that point, says, whatever Silver Pine Forest lacks in functionality insofar as the design of the zone, it more than makes up for in advancing the storyline of the Forsaken. While the actions of the Forsaken are most certainly questionable, in Silver Pine we get more of a glance into their motives, most of which is derived from pain and loss. And I think that's fair. You know, if you set aside the geography and the kind of the slightly unfortunate functionality of the zone, when you really start to dig into all the stuff that's going on there, you know, the storylines that kick off from the sepulchre, the fact that, you know, the place has been infected by both the Forsaken plague and there's the Worgen plague coming in from the south, you know, it's clearly a place that's devastated by a number of different factors, and getting to grips with it and getting your head around all the things that are going on there is, you know, it makes for quite an interesting, quite a detailed and quite an in-depth experience as far as leveling once you're just out of those kind of starting zone levels.
Definitely. I think the absolute standout thing in the zone is the Aragol stuff and the Worgen, the Worgen curse, and there are lots of quests that involve it that take you to all sorts of places, an abandoned mine, you know, a bit of the forest where they're all running free, up to Pyrewood Village, which is fantastic, and of course to Shadowfang Keep, the instance in the zone. I do think the Worgen stuff is the best single reason to go to Silver Pine Forest.
Far and away, definitely.
Yeah.
So that was Hartman's comment. And then Zerman also pointed out, and this is something that we hit as well, this zone was the one to introduce me to pure hate in this game. I hated Son of Aragol more than any other NPC in all of WoW. It seemed like no matter where I quested, he followed me around and killed me at the worst times. And we had the same thing. We were just minding our own business, killing some other Worgen, and all of a sudden this elite drifted into the area. And I don't think, certainly I initially didn't even realise it was an elite. It just looked like yet another Worgen. So all of a sudden we're being pounded on fairly badly, I have
and
to
it's,
say.
It's not, number one, it's not even a level appropriate elite. I think it's like a level 20 elite when everything else is like 13 or 14. Number two, as far as we can tell, there are no quests connected to it, no reason for killing it. It is simply there to piss you off.
Yeah, and as Zerman pointed out, when you do finally kill him, the loot's not that good anyway. So you put a lot of effort into it if you do, and by all means check out the forum thread about this, because he points out that he and a friend ended up ganging up and hunting him down. and Gerlope also mentioned a similar kind of experience when he was giving his comments. And it's true. It's like you suddenly find yourself being pounded on by this thing that's way out of your league, in the middle of some, you know, mindless killing of spiders or something. Eventually, when you come back or when you get a chance to take it down, it turns out not to have been worth the effort. And, you know, it's just one of those things that's there to annoy you. Which, fair enough, you know, some things just do and are, and that's their point in the game. But, yeah, you can do without that in Silver Pine.
He's like a low-level version. It introduces you to the concept of the Fellreaver, basically. but while we're talking about the Worgen, there are two landmarks you absolutely cannot miss in Silverpine, one of which is, and this is the tiniest spoiler, everyone knows this, one of which is definitely going to change, which is the Greymane Wall, which is the wall that the people of Gilneas sealed themselves away with because they were so afraid of what would become of them and the curse, and they didn't want to release themselves on the wider world. So I mean the whole story of the Worgen is fantastic. I'm very jealous of the Alliance getting them as a playable race. What is going to happen in Gilneas is bound to be really interesting. So you've got to go check out the Greymane Wall, and near there Pyrewood Village, which by day is a human village full of unfriendly humans, but by night, and this is a brilliant touch, they all turn into Worgen.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where you kind of think, once you realise that it's basically a werewolf town, you think, oh, wouldn't it be cool if at night this lot were all werewolves? And actually, they are.
Very cool. Very cool indeed. One thing, Thyatira recommended that one of the places we had to see was Fenris Isle. Now, we didn't this time round. I've done it a couple of times on other characters. Just from my point of view, the reason I didn't want to go to Fenris Isle is it's really tough at level, because I think you're getting up to like 16, 17 level mobs there when you're busy doing 12 and 13 quests. But it's kind of worth doing if you're learning the game for one key reason. There's a fortress on Fenris Isle which has been taken over by gnolls. If you want to learn the principles of how to pull single mobs without dragging all their friends along, Fenris Isle is the perfect place to practice, because the mobs' paths cross and they go really close to each other, and it's a very, very hard place to solo, to get right, because you will get absolutely creamed if you pull more than two or three of these things, which is easy to do.
I actually thought you were going somewhere different with that. I thought that you were going to suggest that if you want to learn how to work your way around those buildings that are all based on exactly the same floor plan that we'll keep hitting time and time again from zone to zone across the world, that's one of your first opportunities to do so, because it is the basic floor plan of a whole bunch of other buildings that you
there is fighting that, mobs in. That is true, and we saw that in the human fortress in Durotar. Through the door, turn right, turn left, turn left again, turn right and up the stairs, turn left up the ramp, turn left, there's the key boss to kill. And then if you carry on over the other side, the staircase is up to the roof, where there's bound to be something else hidden as well. They are all the same.
It is true. And there are many of them. And so, you could indeed use that one to learn. The other thing that somebody pointed out is that once upon a time, the mobs on that island were elites.
That was the great patch 2.3 disemboweling.
Everything got hit with the easy stick. Yeah. It used to be far harder. It's still pretty tough, as you say, at level, just because the complexity of the paths and stuff is interesting to deal with.
There is a kind of fun quest there, though, which we will get to as we move on to talk about the quests.
Which is now.
Then talk about the quests.
Okay, so a quest that I really like, and a couple of people mentioned for this zone, is one that actually comes from elsewhere, which is Until Death Do Us Part, and it's the story. It has a story to it of reuniting a pendant with its owner, basically, who is dead. So essentially, you pick up the pendant, you're given the thing to take to the graveyard at the sepulchre, and to reunite it. And it's kind of one of those odd little... It's a strange little quest. It doesn't have a mechanic that's too similar to too many others in the game, but it just has a story to it, and it's kind of quite sad, and it's a little bit touching, and it's just a nice little quest. And it is one of those things that will bring you into the zone, so it's worth picking it up and following it on where it brings you.
Well, altogether, it's an incredibly easy quest to miss, because you pick it up from an NPC called Clarice Foster in Thunderbluff, of all places. But what it actually involves is you kind of expect more of a payoff. You're given this pendant and said, go and look for his grave. And there's some background story to it. Go and look for his grave and return this to him. And you put the pendant on the grave, and all you get is this dialogue box on screen, like a normal quest one. Just talking about how, the wind howls through the trees and basically nothing happens apart from you get some XP. But it's under the right circumstances. It really puts a chill down your spine, because it's really quite mournful, quite melancholy. That there's no happy ending here, basically, which I think is a really, again, really keys into the feel of the undead and the feel of these zones. It's a really good quest.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to pick up a Pyrewood quest at this point, because I really, really like it. And I didn't know it was there for the longest time. Ages ago, when I was doing Loremaster on Arezzo, I discovered this just because I was looking desperately for quests. If you go into Pyrewood Village, and there are a couple of quests that will take you there, but when you get into the village itself, you'll suddenly spot an exclamation mark inside one of the buildings.
Can I just interrupt you to offer a little... a little power gaming hint here. When you're heading to Pyrewood Village, don't just walk through the front door. Follow the fence round on the left-hand side, and eventually you'll find a little gap which you can jump through. And when you jump through, you're right behind the building with this quest giver in it. And also, you're kind of safely hidden away, and you can pick off the werewolves one by one.
There you go. Hints and tips. So anyway, when you get in there and you find this this quest giver, the quest giver is obviously somebody who's on your side, who is actually there with a specific mission, which is to kill the Pyrewood Village Council. And she asks for your help. And so basically, when you accept the quest, you wait for a few seconds, and then the first group of council members come in, and you have to kill them, and then another group come in, and you have to kill them, and another group come in, and you have to kill them, and then you've completed the quest. But it's one of those kind of almost like espionage quests that you get in the game, and there aren't enough of them, I don't think, but it's just kind of fun because you're lying in wait rather than having to go hunting out for stuff. And it, again, it's part of that story. There is a story here about people trying to deal with the menace that Pyrewood Village represents because it is infested by Worgen. And you know, you stumble across somebody who's part of that mission, part of that goal, and you have an opportunity to help them. I just think it's really nice, and I think it's unexpected because you find it in some way you're not expecting to pick up a new quest. You're expecting to just go in there and kill a load of stuff for the quest you've already got. So I like that one a lot.
And one other quest you should check out while you're there, because it leads to a chain involving the Dalaran wizards, is Border Crossings. Not an interesting quest in itself, but the whole chain will take you through and introduce you to these wizards who will... I mean, obviously, when you're in Northrend, they become very important because the Kirin Tor control Dalaran, and that's your main city. And yes, and a few people made this point, they seem to turn a blind eye to the fact that a lot of Horde characters spent much of their younger years killing all their people in Silverpine. But, you know, there's some good fun quests involving involving Ambermill Village, which is kind of the Dalaran base in the area. And that's a chain well worth checking out for that kind of basis.
Yeah, and obviously it kind of made a lot more sense to have all these Dalaran wizards wandering around when there used to be Dalaran itself just down the road across the border into Hillsbrad. Since it's gone, I'm not entirely sure why they're still hanging around, but I guess they've got their reasons.
Yeah, you'd think they would have... I mean, Dalaran's a nice place to be again now. You'd think they'd be all hanging out there. But no, if they're hanging around wanting to be killed by us, then we should indulge their desires. Okay, that's Silverpine, and while we're still in the Eastern Kingdoms, let's head over to the Blood Elf zone of Ghostlands.
The color and beauty of Eversong changes dramatically to an eerie landscape of shade and gloom as you cross the border into the Ghostlands. From the town of Tranquillion, explorers can discover a network of ancient Blood Elf villages and landmarks, most of which are now abandoned and overrun by gargoyles, ghosts, and worse. The Dead Scar continues to dominate these parts of the world, and at its southernmost point stands the Citadel of Deathholm, the heart of the Scourge infestation of the region. The strongest other force in the region is the Imani Trolls, who cling to the remains of their once mighty empire from their city at Zul'aman.
Okay, I'll be upfront and I will say right from the outset, I absolutely love the Ghostlands. I think the atmosphere is amazing, the sense of eerie desolation that's there, the colours with all that kind of weird phosphorescence on the trees and stuff like that, all of that together, I think, just make for an unbelievably atmospheric zone. And I think when you come to it, as a couple of people on the forum thread mentioned, when you come to it from the brightness and the prettiness and the colourfulness of Eversong, it's a real shock, and I just think it's fantastic. Really, really like it.
There is. We decided when we were going through it, there is a real sense that something here has gone wrong, and it's great. The quests are really, I mean, we know this. We talked about this before. The quests are really well designed. They lead you through not just a progression in game mechanics, but a progression in story, and you learn more about the zone and about the history of the Horde races, not just the Blood Elves, but the undead here. It is an incredibly well-designed zone on lots of levels. Coming to this project this time, I think when I looked at the three we're dealing with in this show, if you'd asked me before we set out this time round, I would have said Ghostlands is my favourite. Less so now. Honestly, I found it a little too samey, a little too uniform compared to somewhere like Silverpine or the Barrens. But all that said, it is an incredibly well-designed zone, and it was a popular one with you.
Yeah, and actually, just to comment on that, I will say, even though I do love it, I do feel a little bit overexposed to it, because ever since it was introduced into the game, every character that I have leveled through 10 to 20, I've taken them to the Ghostlands rather than sticking in the Old World. And I think that's, you know, I think that's something that a lot of people have done, and so yeah, I feel overexposed to it, much as I do love it.
Yeah, I think that actually might be the case with me. I've pretty much done it on every character I've ever leveled, chiefly. And some of you mentioned this chiefly because the quest rewards are so good there. They're so well itemized that it's a really good place to gear up at low level. So yeah, maybe it's just that I've grown a bit tired of it. And there's lots to recommend it, definitely. But yes, let's look at some of your comments.
Sure. So starting with Thyatira, the Ghostlands is another one he doesn't like. Ugh, ugh, ugh. I hated and still hate the Ghostlands. Maybe it's the colour, maybe it's how everything is dead. I don't know. It feels like one giant dead scar. Going from the beauty of Eversong Woods to the nastiness and ugliness of the Ghostlands is almost too much to bear. Now, you see, that's, you know, he clearly feels exactly the opposite of me, because I think that's a really impressive shift. He thinks it's a very negative shift. But each to their own, obviously. Gunasaurus pointed out his interesting bit on Ghostlands. I had no idea it even existed until I joined this guild. I guess I just figured that once I got to around level 10 to 12, it was time to go to the Barrens. So that's what I did. Go figure. I guess I should go check it out. Well, hopefully we can give you some suggestions for things you should check out when you go. OMF also commented, and this picks up on what you were just saying. Let's face it, we all know why everyone comes here to quest in the 10 to 20 zone. It's got far better itemized rewards. It's not overly ginormous like the Barrens, nor does it have the irritatingly impossible to navigate terrain of Silverpine. Let it go, OMF. It has very cool eerie atmosphere and a very fun chain of quests, culminating in a great showdown with Darkhand Drathir. And you know, that kind of sums up all the great things about the zone, really. And as he points out, people do come here because, as we mentioned about Eversong, you know, Blizzard learned some stuff between creating vanilla WoW and launching the Burning Crusade.
I think this is a good point to go slightly off topic and talk about the zone mechanically, because several of your comments picked up on the quests in the zone and the rewards in the zone and how those were better designed. I think Ghostlands, and it's interesting there isn't an Alliance equivalent at this level, because the new Draenei starting zones don't do this. I think Ghostlands introduces you to one or two really key concepts of the game. First of all, there's grouping. There are two kind of key quests which you cannot solo. You can't hope to solo them. And they're the ones with the two Wandering Elite abominations, Knuckle Rot and Lurzen, and the final quest of the Darkhand chain, where really you need, unless you've got heirloom gear, because I think we managed to do Darkhand just the two of us.
We did, yeah.
But it was tough. I think we died once or twice.
Possibly, yeah. But
yeah, the Darkhand quest, it needs a really good group of a good number of people. So these two kind of very key quests are forcing you. If you want to finish the story of the Ghostlands, you have to do it in a party. As well as that, we've got a comment here from Eldekar. When you enter Tranquillion, one of the NPCs you meet is Provisioner Vredigar, who offers you really nice rewards as you gain reputation with Tranquillion. As you complete quests in the zone, you'll increase your reputation and get some great gear. While rep really comes into play later in the game, i.e. at endgame, this is a great way to become aware of reputation and why you might care as a player relatively early in your toon's life. And that is the single biggest thing that has always struck me about Ghostland and about Tranquillion, is how it introduces you to the reputation system.
Yeah.
And this guy, Vredigar, has rewards you can get. Anyone who's familiar with reputation is already familiar with this. You get rewards at Honored, you get new rewards at Revered and at Exalted, and these things will last you a long time. But the weird thing about it is, anyone who's done a rep grind at level 70 or 60 or 80 knows that these things take time. But it will take you an afternoon to get Exalted with Tranquillion. The amount of reputation you get for a quest is huge. Now, for someone new to the game, rolling through Tranquillion for the first ever time and going, if this is how reputation works, great. They're going to get a really nasty shock at level 80.
Yeah, but it's definitely one of those things that we've noticed since the very first time we went through there is that it is an introduction to Rep like no other in the game. And also, you know, as you said, the whole zone is structured. It's like when you turn in the last of the quests on the Tranquillian line, that is calculated to get you to Exalted. It's like it's going to happen. So unless you just skip a bunch of those quests or just never finish the zone, you're going to get your first Exalted Rep really early in the game compared to how it used to be.
Now, an interesting topic that came up in your comments was something that actually has now changed the way we're doing this. A couple of you mentioned the music in the zone. Now, Arezzo and I, we never ever play with the in-game music on. I'm either listening to a podcast or to my own music or something like that. And I never listen to the music in the game. And there must be so many zones that where I just don't know what the music sounds like. But one or two of you really drew attention to the music in this game. So we thought, all right, we have to check this out. So we have turned it on now and we are playing with music. And again, just last night, spoilers, we were off in Stone Talon and the music there was really interesting and it adds a new level. So what one point, before we go to your comments on the Ghostlands music, one point I wanted to make is if you don't play with the music on, you are kind of missing something out.
Yeah, completely. I've always regarded the music as a distraction, and I've never played with it on. So this has been a little bit of an eye-opener, or ear-opener, possibly, for me as far as my experience of the game is concerned, which is proving an unexpected bonus. I was not expecting that as an additional experience as part of this particular project. Anyway, so a couple of people who mentioned things specifically. Carius says, Ghostland kills with the atmosphere. Even back in parts of Silvermoon, the artistic directors coupled with Brower's score, that's Russell Brower, the composer, have done wonders in these zones, creating suffocating tones of loss, regret, and a general weight of the forlorn. It's a very emphatic tie to the drama of the Blood Elves, their corruption and fall from purity, which is a typically bardic way of putting it. Thank you, Carius. And then Stig also said, and he was the first one to really draw my attention to this, is that what really makes the zone so special for me is the music. It's easily my favourite zone music in the game. As you get absorbed in a particular quest or task, it fades into the background, but then the cello part rolls in like the mist, and I always get goose flesh. And he goes on to tell the story that when I got the chance to talk to Russell Brower at the last BlizzCon, he told me that he'd received a letter from a young girl who decided to play the cello after hearing the music in the Ghostlands, and that it was one of the crowning moments of his career as a composer, which you've got to imagine, you know, inspiring somebody to take up an instrument must rank fairly high on that scale. But yeah, this is something that's totally new to me, and I'm really, really enjoying it, and I'm really appreciative that people took the trouble to point it out and make me aware of what I'd been missing all this time.
Okay, staying with the topic of music, but moving on to the quests in the zone, one absolute must-see quest is called the Lady's Necklace, which is started by a drop from the mobs around a place called Windrunner Spire. Now, Windrunner might ring a bell if you don't know the zone. That is, of course, the surname of Lady Sylvanas, the leader of the undead, who herself was once a blood elf. And this whole, the quests in the zone, and this one in particular, really show the link between these two races and how the undead came from their blood elf roots. But this quest in particular, you'll find a necklace, it starts a quest, eventually you'll return it to Lady Sylvanas, and it will be revealed that it was a gift to her from her departed sister, Illyria. Now, here's the crucial thing. If you've never done this quest, or if you have done this quest but you've never had your music turned on when you do it, make sure you do have your music on, because Sylvanas will sing you a song. And you get this incredible, she has like ghostly backing singers and this incredible light show. And it's a beautiful little song. And the whole thing is really heartbreaking. Particularly if you know the story of Sylvanas and the fall of the Blood Elf people that led to the birth of the undead race and all that background. It's some really solid lore. And it's one of the few really touching things in the game, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And it's it's a sight to see as well. I mean, you know, setting aside all the lore stuff, it's just a great experience. One of the things that a lot of people do, and I did this myself this time around, is when they're about to turn that quest in, they'll announce that they're going to do it so that anybody who's around Undercity can see, that can have the experience and can see the quest turn in and the song, just because it's a thing that, you know, people like to share. And it can sometimes be a really great moment when a lot of people come into Sylvanas' chamber in Undercity to listen to the song and to see that turn in. Yeah, it's a really nice one. I like that one a lot. And actually, the reason that you're likely to have gone to Windrun Aspire in the first place is a quest called Retaking Windrun Aspire, which basically means that you've got to go and kill a bunch of stuff. Now, the quest itself isn't very interesting, but Windrun Aspire itself is a highlight of the zone, as far as I'm concerned. It's a big old bit of Blood Elf architecture sitting up on a cliff over the sea with those big sweeping arc walkways that actually do run out over the cliff and over the sea. And it's just a stunning location. And the quest is a bit ordinary, but don't miss the opportunity to explore the area. And you might as well get the quest and the experience while you're there. But yeah, Windrun Aspire, definitely a must-see for the Ghostlands.
It must be said in the zone that a lot of the quests are pretty ordinary. I mean, the Lady's Necklace is absolutely the standout one.
Yeah.
Of the zone, if not the game, certainly around that level. But what the quests there do is they introduce you to... They're very well designed. They're all very close together. There's lots of kill 10 of this, take 10 of these from their body kind of quests. But they'll send you to various points, and introduce you to interesting things in the zone. There are some night elves who are staging an incursion into Blood Elf land, so you have to fight back. There are some trolls you have to fight back. And the trolls, of course, are pretty good, because one of the other important things in Ghostlands is the entrance to Zul Aman, the 10-player level 70 raid. Great raid instance, and the whole area around Solomon. You can go and look at it at level 10 or whatever. There's nothing there that's going to kill you as long as you don't go inside, but it's that kind of sits in the middle of these troll villages, so you're kind of running around killing them, and there's a sense of these things going on, and it is all very well done, almost, dare I say it, to the point of sterility. It's all almost too well done.
Ooh, harsh and possibly controversial. Yeah, I know what you mean. But just to pick up very quickly on that that whole troll area, and as was mentioned in the little kind of snippet introducing the zone, you know, the Amani trolls are one of the kind of the big troll empires there, and this is the kind of the last vestiges of them around Zul Aman. There's a bunch of quests here that, you know, that get you to kill various kinds of trolls and retrieve various things and kill the chief of the trolls and all that kind of stuff. And they are a little bit like, you know, go here, kill some of those, come back, and I'll send you out to kill some different ones. But the feeling of that troll area, I think, is really cool. It's also really, it's one of those areas, that, again, that's quite risky. You know, there's a lot of patrols, there's a lot of different kinds of troll mobs, including some that are hunters that have pets, and so, you know, again, it's one of those little areas where if you get a little too far in, you can get quite out of your depth at level quite easily.
Definitely, and there's some of the higher level mobs in the zone as well, so there is a risk of you going there a little bit too early and being overwhelmed.
Yeah,
but all that said, you see, you're not saying to me it's amazing. You have to see it. I honestly don't think there is anything in Ghostlands that is amazing. You have to see it. There's nothing like that.
I think Windrun Aspire is.
But, and I know Mef agreed with you, and absolutely the view from Windrun Aspire is great, and it's a fantastic piece of architecture, but we've seen that before. We saw that in Eversong Woods, that kind of architecture. It's just the place that it is here.
Yeah, that's fair.
Ghostlands as a whole, aesthetically, has a lot going for it. You know, the glowing mushrooms, the gloominess, the colour palette is all great. The quests, are, like we've said time and again, are brilliantly designed. But I honestly don't think there's anything absolute standout. There are things you can say about Silverpine, and we have, like Powerwood Village or the Son of Aragal Elite. There are things you can say about the Barons, and we will go on to say that. But, and believe me, this is the groundbreaking thing with me for having done this. To come out and say that right now, as the game stands right now, I actually had a bit more fun in the Barons and saw more interesting things than, I know, than I did in Ghostlands. That surprises me.
Yeah, that surprises me too. I do know what you mean. And I do, to a certain extent, agree. I think I had less of a problem with it than you did, although I did, like I say, feel I'd overexposed myself to it with a number of different characters. We haven't mentioned one of the big landmarks, of course, which is Death Home, which is down at the bottom end of the Dead Scar. Again, it's not necessarily a place that you've really got to go and see because it's so amazing. It is the place that you know, you're going to get to at the end of that big quest chain that we talked about. And once you get inside it, it's pretty damn scary. There's some really nasty mobs in there, and it's not a very pleasant place. But you know, you're right, it's not a huge standout. You must see this if you're just there on a tour. You've got to do it if you're doing the quest chain, but you don't have to do it if you're just touring the world and looking for the highlights from the tourist point of view. Yeah, you're right. On that basis, it's not the most scintillating zone.
Yeah, sorry, Ghostlands. I think you're only going to get a 6 out of 10 for me.
Ooh. Okay, so that's the Ghostlands. And now our third zone for this show, we're moving on to, heaven help us, the Barrens.
One of the most aptly named regions in Azeroth, the Barrens encompasses a huge area in the middle of Kalimdor, stretching from Ashenvale to the north to Thousand Needles in the south. The vast grassy savanna is home to roaming herds of zebra, giraffe, and kodo, as well as the more aggressive lions, hyenas, and raptors. Around the scattered lush oases, centaur tribes have established themselves, making the areas dangerous for those seeking water and shelter from the harsh sun. The settlements at the crossroads and Camp Tarajo provide safer resting points for Horde travelers, though the former is a scene of regular incursions by Alliance intruders. Beware! The Goblin Port of Ratchet provides additional resources, as well as access by ship to the southern tip of the Eastern Kingdoms.
Okay, the last big zone we're looking at in this show, the Barrens. I mean, it's mythical. It's legendary among Horde players, among all players of the game, for various reasons, which you all kind of picked up on in your comments. But the one thing that strikes you about the Barrens the minute you walk into it is the size of it, the openness of it. Velitha said something particularly nice about this. Velitha leveled originally as Alliance, and he talks about some of the Alliance starting zones in comparison. He says that Azure Mist is small and compact, and Darkshore and Ashenvale have mountains and woods to obscure the landscape. So the Barrens was the first time I saw fully open skies. And it's true. A couple of other people likened it to Africa, which is obviously the kind of obvious comparison with the giraffes and the zebras wandering around, or zebras, however you want to pronounce them. That's the obvious kind of touchstone for the zone, it's meant to be very African in style. The music's quite African with some added orcs. But yeah, that's kind of the feel of it, is these golden African kind of savanna type plains. One thing we decided when we were doing this was that we'd actually leave the Barrens until we hit level 20 for one major reason, because we just did not want to go there without mounts. The place is enormous and it is brutal to get around without a mount.
It is. It's not even like a fun long haul like some of the other bigger zones can be. It's just because it's so open, because that kind of savanna feel is so unending. I mean, it feels even more open and unending than Mulgore did. And, you know, we talked about that last time and how that can get a bit on your nerves. But running through the Barrens is absolutely, you know, it's like the far end of that scale. It's so dull if you're just wandering around without a mount.
Yeah. Another big weakness of the zones is the majority of the quests are simple kill 10 quests. There's not a lot of strength there in the quests, but the atmosphere, the size of the zone, it's a blessing and a curse. Like Velitha says, just going there for the first time, and Warak says as well, he talks about the flight path over it looking really impressive, because it is just this huge expanse. And that is one of the most striking things about the zone. It is one of the best things of the zone, but it's one of the worst things of the zone.
Yeah.
And I think back in the days when you couldn't get any kind of mount until you were level 40, so, you know, questing in the Barrens with a mount was just out of the question. It was a hard old slog, and a lot of people avoided it. And I think that's why everyone went to Ghostlands.
Yeah, I think the Ghostlands effect is actually, you know, almost by definition the anti-Barons effect. That's why people went, because, you know, to a large extent, especially if you're Horde and you're starting, you know, as anything other than undead in vanilla, you know, your starting zones were all next door to the Barons. You were going to come out of Mulgore into the Barons, or you were going to come out of Durotar into the Barons. And they were really, you know, that was where you were going to go. And all of a sudden, the Ghostlands represented this major new opportunity. And I can certainly see that it's, you know, it's a Baron's effect that drove people there rather than specifically the Ghostlands themselves.
But for all its size, if you spend some time in the Barons, you'll very quickly learn what a kind of central place it plays for leveling and for some of the things it introduces in the game. For a start, there's Ratchet, which is likely to be the very first goblin town you will ever come across.
Yeah, and alongside that, which when I looked at it as part of this project, I realised the very first time you're going to hit a Flightmaster that doesn't just have Windriders at it, which is a weirdly odd moment.
Yeah, yes. I hadn't considered that, but yes, that's true. And Ratchet's going to stay. I mean, there's tons of quests there, and the quests, you can start getting them from like level 12, and it will keep giving you new quests well into your 20s and maybe above. And it will remain important, Ratchet, because you will use it a lot because of the ship link to Booty Bay on the other continent. and you will spend a lot of time going via Booty Bay to places. So Ratchet becomes a very important kind of hub.
Yeah.
Another kind of important hub is the Crossroads. And the Crossroads will, bless it, stay relevant to you right through to the end game, because it remains one of the only places left where spontaneous world PvP still happens.
To everybody's delight, obviously.
Well, the Alliance always want to chance their arm attacking Crossroads, killing the tradesmen, killing the quest givers, and inevitably a Horde counterattack force will gather there. I challenge our listeners to say that they have never taken part in PvP at the Barons, because it happens. And I think it's a good, if you're playing the game for the first time, I think it's a great level for it to happen at. You know, that kind of low level, and you kind of learn that there's this conflict, there is this war, and that you are a part of it, and that your people are a target.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that somebody mentioned is that the Barons actually does feel like contested territory. And you know, and the Crossroads is a classic example of that. In fact, I remember back in the day when you and I were first playing on European servers and were playing Alliance side, the guild that we were in got involved in a raid on the Crossroads, and we came along. It was the first time, and I just stood there not knowing what the hell was going on.
In fairness, that raid was a response to a Horde raid on Oberdeen in Darkshore,
yeah,
the Night Elf place, because that Oberdeen is kind of the Alliance equivalent to Crossroads in that regard. Doesn't seem to happen quite as much to Oberdeen, but I remember back in the day, Horde were always attacking that place. And there are lots of other reasons to hang around in the Barons at any level, particularly on an RP server. If you want to make a spot of money here or there, it's worth heading to the oases outside the Wailing Caverns and fishing in the lakes there for deviant fish, with which to make Deviant Delight, which, if you've never eaten it, you have to. It gives you a random chance of turning into either a pirate, with the best sound effect in the game, a pirate or a ninja, and that's good fun.
Yeah, and it, again, it's one of those strange things that, you know, you can actually do at level, something that most people only end up playing with at much higher level. You can fish up those deviant fish at a relatively low level fishing, and make a bit of money and you know, stockpile the things so that you can run around the world as a pirate.
Yeah.
Which is, let's face it, best thing ever.
The recipe for Deviant Delight is a random drop off Baron mobs, so you might have to spend some time farming that. If you happen to find two of them, your quid's in, because it goes for a few hundred gold. And the Deviant Delight themselves, and even just the raw Deviant fish, if you're a level 10 character with no money, and this is your first character on the realm, or your first character in the game, this is a great way, you easily, you know, with a couple of stacks of fish, you'll have enough to buy your first mount when level 20 comes around. Easily, you can earn some significant cash here.
So that's one of the standout landmark areas in the zone. There's a couple of others, obviously. One that that everyone should check out, and there's a couple of quests that we'll send you there. In fact, one of the very first quests when you come into the Barrens from Durotar, we'll send you there, is Dreadmist Peak, which is just brilliant. It's just one of the hills that looks just like any of the other hills in the Barrens. You have to get up the side of it using the kind of the slightly occasionally problematic bluffs that kind of go up to it. But one of the things that happens as you get higher up to it is that it just gets darker and mistier and gloomier.
It's kind of blood red mist, isn't it?
More and more creepy as you get to the top. And then when you get to the top, there's actually a couple of different quest chains that will lead you there. In fact, there's another one from a higher level that will bring you back that you can pick up in Ashenvale, I think. But this first one is relatively low level. It's relatively straightforward. But once you get up there, it's like nowhere else in the game. And the fact that it literally happens progressively as you get higher up this mountain is just really a really nice little touch. Definitely check out Dreadmist if you go into the Barrens.
And that is one of the other things about the Barrens. For all that everyone picks up on its size and its value, vastness and its kind of African savanna qualities, there is variety there, and it's surprising variety. All the oases where the centaurs roam are these lush tropical palm trees around these great lakes, and they're lovely little places, just breaking up the kind of golden grasses all the way around. There is variety here. There's water, there's mountains. It isn't as flat and boring as it looks. And it's great. I really enjoyed it. Actually, I think, like we were saying before, we've got so used to leveling characters from 10 to 20 or thereabouts through Ghostlands that coming here and doing the Barrens gave me a massive new appreciation of it.
Yeah, likewise.
And all of a sudden, for the first time, and I think this is the first, because we know the Barrens is going to be quite seriously affected in the Cataclysm. The thing about the Barrens, let's go back to the comments people gave. Velitha said, I think the game keeps you going back to the Barrens for too long. I was still turning quests in there in the 30s. And we've got a comment from Gerlope who says basically the same thing. Eventually I got tired because I spent too much time there. Most of my alts never made it past the low 20s. Because if you don't know any better, you can spend forever. You can spend from level 10 well into your 20s in the whole of the Barrens, because near the top, the Northern Barrens, around Crossroads, that's where you start level 10. But then you'll move further down to Camp Toraho, the next Horde town down. And there you get quests that take you into your early and through to mid and late 20s. And there's two... there are three instances throughout the Barrens. There's two down at the bottom end that are high-level instances. Mm. If you don't know any better, you can spend so long there, it isn't surprising you'd get bored of it. You would get bored of the most amazing variety-packed zone if you spent all that time there.
Yeah, I think the first character that I leveled through there at level back in the days before heirloom items and all of that kind of stuff, I think I was there until I think I was still hearthed to the Crossroads until at least level 25. Even though by that point I was probably adventuring, you know, in the southern parts of the Barrens as well. The Crossroads, because it's got all the tradespeople, because it's got the inn, because it's got all of that kind of stuff, you do tend to use it as the base. But I was there forever.
So this is the point Blizzard have realised, and we all pretty much know that in Cataclysm, the Barrens is going to get literally cut in half to represent the fact that the top half of it is for lower level characters, the bottom half of it is for slightly higher level characters. So we know that the Barrens is going to be massively, massively changed from how it is now. We know the oases are going to spread out a bit more. It's going to change a lot. The point I was trying to make in all this is for the first time in this leveling project now, I've finally hit something I'm actually really going to miss as it stands now. And like I said earlier, I'm surprised that the thing I'm saying this about so far is the Barrens, of all places.
Yeah, of all places.
there just is absolutely something about it. It's very hoardy. in some ways it brings together the geography of the Tauren lands and the Orc lands. So it kind of represents a melting pot. And not only does it bring together the geographies, but the quests, it's the geographical point where, you know, the Taurens come from one direction, the Orcs and Trolls come from another, and you meet, where better, at the crossroads.
Oh, yeah.
And then you start your journey together as Horde. I think actually that element of the design of it is really strong, really powerful. I can't imagine we'll be losing that because it's not moving anywhere. But, you know, I've discovered a new fondness for the Barrens as it stands.
Yeah, I think it is one of those things. It gets a bad rap, and it gets a bad rap largely because people just, you know, it's got that name, which doesn't help, frankly. And it's got that impression that people have of it, that it's just big open savanna. But as you were saying earlier, and as we really clearly rediscovered this time around, there's actually a surprising amount of variety in the Barrens. And I think once you can get past the need to run around everywhere, and you can get on a mount and get around, you get much more opportunity to explore that variety. You know, the area around Ratchet is completely different than the area around the Crossroads, which is completely different again than, you know, some of the other parts of the zone. It's much more varied than its name suggests, or that its rep would have you believe. And I think that's been the big surprise for me.
Yes, but going back to our original point, we did make sure we had a mount before we went.
Yeah, don't walk.
And I think that's what really, really did make the difference in how we felt about it.
Yeah, although interestingly, that picks up on something that OMF said as well, which I just wanted to touch on as well. He says, you know, I have very fond memories of leveling Dakar through the Barrens and thinking just how big it was and how big the whole world seemed in comparison. Now, with epic flyers and so many flight points, teleportation spells, the world doesn't seem so large anymore. I'm looking forward to flying over the revamped world in Cataclysm. I think it'll help recapture that feeling. And I think that is fair. I think we kind of did the cheat to make that part of the world feel a bit smaller. And I do think that, as he says, one of the things that's slightly been lost as things have been shifted around by Blizzard, you know, in terms of the leveling process in the old world in particular, is once upon a time, I think this exercise, this project, would have felt a little bit more epic than it's going to feel for us, because it would have taken us longer to get around, and it would have meant, you know, more effort involved to really appreciate everything.
But back in the day, we wouldn't have done this quite so many times before, and we wouldn't. The idea now of leveling an alt and not being able to have a mount until 40, that just makes my blood run cold, because it would just be so boring.
Oh yeah, I mean, to be fair, back in the day we would have been cursing Blizzard's name and saying, why can't we get around this place any faster?
Absolutely, but yeah, I mean, way back when, everything was still new and fresh, and obviously there is more than one way to level through the game. So back then, yeah, it would have felt epic because it would have felt new, but it doesn't feel new anymore. Oh, well, that said, it kind of does. I'd not been to Dreadmist Peak before. And when we come on to talk about the quests in the Barrens, I discovered a new quest I'd never done before, which I was like giggling because it was so much fun. But we'll talk about that in
a
minute.
He giggles. Yeah. He's a terrible giggler.
But that's the thing about leveling. Right now, as it stands, as this version of Azeroth is going away, it is that mix between, we're really very used to this, we've seen it all before, and the purpose of this, in a way, is saying, let's really go hunting, let's really see new things.
Let's get into the skin of it a bit.
And again, I think I mentioned before, we were just in Stone Talon last night, the stuff I found there, the stuff I found in the Barrens, that I'd never seen before. It's great. It's really great. And it's. I hope, as listeners, you're enjoying this. And if anyone's also, you know, rolling an alt through at this point, I hope you're enjoying this last chance to see everything the way it is. And the Barrens, don't skip it, I think is what we're saying.
Yeah.
Don't prejudge it. Go back there. Give it a chance. And I think you might be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, and I think hopefully, and we'll talk about this specifically more in the next show, but the Stone Talon moment last night, which is when I pointed out to Gaffoni something that I took him somewhere that he hadn't been before. You know, he was actually, you know, oh my godding at the shock that there was something that he had never seen.
Yeah,
and I think we can have those moments now.
Oh, absolutely. But the Stone Talon one, and I don't want to talk too much about the next show, but the Stone Talon one, it wasn't just just look at this little shrine in the corner, or look at this little house in the corner, or this NPC you've never seen before. It was, and this is why it surprised me so much, it was, look at this enormous thing that you have never seen. I was like, well, how have I missed this all these years? So yeah, that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Anyway, but enough of that. So talking about the quests in the Barrens, which is the next thing we should really cover. We touched briefly on the fact that there are a couple that will bring you in and take you up Dreadmist. So don't miss out on those. I'm going to start down in the south, just because I'm contrary that way. There's a couple of quests. There's one that starts with a character called Gan, who is a Tauren who walks the road, the southern part of the Gold Road, just before the entrance down into Thousand Needles. And he is going to give you a quest that will take you into Bale Modan, which is an area of dwarven activity in the Barrens. There's an excavation site, and then there's a fortified building alongside it, and you're going to get sent in there to retrieve some items and then to use those items. It's kind of weird that this quest is one that I didn't do for an awfully long time, because you can't miss this guy as you walk down the road, and more importantly, it's quite hard to miss that there is in fact quite a significant dwarvish incursion, including, you know, some dwarven architecture that's clearly been established for quite some time. So the quest is actually just a little bit, kill a bunch of dwarves and get stuff off their bodies and stuff like that. But so it's not terribly exciting, but it is just one of those areas in the zone, like I was saying about variety, that just really opens your eyes to all the stuff that's going on there. There's also, while you're there, on the kind of the bluff at the back of the excavation area, there's an NPC who has a quest that you shouldn't miss, because it's easy to miss, but don't forget to pick it up if you're in that neck of the woods.
One other thing, this is the first time you'll meet these in the game. The Silithids are to be found in the Barrens, again, down in the south, so you're not going to hit them until you're in your 20s, really. The Silithids, of course, are everywhere on Kalimdor in various zones. Their nests and hives are hidden, and they became very important at level 60, with the end game there. So this kind of introduces their story. It doesn't say a great deal about them. The quests aren't terrifically interesting, but it's an introduction, and you will keep coming across these things as you level.
Yeah, it's one of those things that we mentioned in the previous couple of shows. Certain things that actually are fairly significant through the life of the game start to be introduced a lot earlier than you might think. And the Silithids are clearly one of those, because generally speaking, people think of those as being, you know, that's Silithus, and to a certain extent, certain parts of Ferelas and some other zones, but not the Barrens. And that, yet there they are already, you know, asserting their influence and starting to creep into the landscape.
And just going back to the geography of the zone as a kind of game crossroads, you get kind of everywhere from the Barrens. North, you go into Ashenvale, there's back into Mulgore, there's back into Durotar, south down into Thousand Needles, and then of course there's the exit into Duskwallow Marsh. It connects, oh, and Stone Talon, can you get, yeah, yeah, Stone Talon as well, yeah. from the Barrens. You can get to a lot of different places. It's a kind of key zone.
It is the hub of Kalimdor.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you get, when you're on the ground, certainly, you're going to end up going through it to get from practically any zone to almost any other.
And of course, while you're travelling through there, you will have the delights of Barrens Chat. Now, this Barrens Chat is mythical, is legend in the game, as being full of, on the one hand, people who are new to the game and wanting to learn how it all works. On the other hand, people who are old hands who are just unbearably cruel.
And jaded, let's say jaded.
Yes. And then, of course, there's the Chuck Norris jokes, which are legendary throughout the Barrens. Now, we've got to admit, we saw nothing. Barrens Chat was basically dead.
Yeah.
And I think it pretty much has been every time I've been through there. But we didn't do one thing. It was suggested to us by Alicia on the forums. And she and her husband, Calum, whenever they're taking alts through there, they always start the Chuck Norris jokes off. And they have some witty banter with other people in the zone. And maybe we should have done a bit of Chuck Norris outreach like they do. Maybe we're the ones at fault.
I'm now really, really worried by the prospect of Chuck Norris outreach.
Yeah. But no, we let it slide. Baron's chat was dead. I mean, the chat generally around the world is... I just want you all, actually, right this minute, to imagine not just day one of Cataclysm. Right, you know day one of the Burning Crusade? Everyone's in Hellfire. General is just full of people saying... Where's this for this quest? How do you do this quest? Where's the quest giver for this? Where's the horde base? Where do I go? What do I do?
Wow.
Full of it. And just on and on and on and on. And again, when Wrath came out, you're in Borean Tundra or you're in the Howling Fjord, and that's all that general chat was. Just busy, busy, busy. But then after a couple of weeks, maybe a month, it's back to normal. No one's talking. No one's talking at all. And that's what it's like in the Barrens. I now want you to imagine what it's going to be like after Cataclysm. From 1 to 85, it's going to be the same. Every zone's general chat will light up again. And I'm not saying it'll last forever, but I think the effect of it, because the changes are so much and so many, I think the effect of it will be quite long-lasting.
And actually, one other great, potentially great side effect of that, and I'm really hoping that this will happen, is that... you know, these days, if you're in any of the low-level zones in particular and somebody asks a question, you know, where do I find this quest giver? Where do I find X or Y? Somebody, 9 times out of 10, will respond in some negative kind of way and call them a noob or something. And I think the benefit of half of us not having any idea, and more than half of us not having any idea what the answers to the questions are going to be going forward, it might actually minimize the number of people who take a really negative approach. And start helping, having people actually help each other out, because they'll learn something themselves now, as opposed to just rattling off the standard answers that they've been rattling off for 5 years now.
I would like to think that's true, but I probably have less faith in the World of Warcraft player base than you do.
Which is ironic, considering I am far and away more misanthropic than you are in the real world.
Okay, now we're back on the subject of questing. Alicia and a couple of other people told us to check out the Samoflange quest chain. They told us to do the whole thing. Now, as far as we're aware, we did do the whole thing.
We think we're missing something.
We must be missing something. We don't know whether we're missing a quest or missing the joke, because we just we're like, what?
Yeah, we got to the end of it, we kind of went
and we checked it on Wowhead, and we didn't seem to be missing another quest in the chain. The whole idea of it seems to be it's a goblin in Ratchet, isn't it? I think, who sends you off on the initial quest to look for a thing called a Samoflange and turn it off or break it in some way or figure out how it works.
His memory is...
Well, no, this is kind of the point of the quest, because then you hand it back and he goes, oh, I'm really not sure about this, but obviously this person will know. And you go and see this another goblin and they say, oh, I'm not sure about this either, but obviously you need the doohickey. And you're sent on this series of quests where you don't really know what you're doing or why.
There is a kind of little joke in the quest text where they're all kind of like, oh, wow, it's a Samoflange. Not sure what one is, but it's pretty cool. And that's a kind of thread through the dialogues. But yeah,
we think that's the point.
Yeah.
And we think that's the joke. But the whole thing is you just don't understand it.
Yeah.
Now, there's a chance we're missing something.
Yeah.
If we are, please let us know.
Yeah, please.
There's a chance we're going to hit something in a few levels which sends us back to the Barrens and we're going to pick all this stuff up again and it'll be like some great revelation. We'll finally understand what the big deal is about the Samoflange. But right now, it's like, why did we do that?
I know. And Alicia even says, you know, I think I've still got a piece of that somewhere in one of my bags. It's like... Okay.
Really?
Why? What? Don't understand.
Yeah, so that was an odd one.
Yeah.
Another standout quest. You have to do. It takes no time at all, and it's as legendary as... In fact, he's probably World of Warcraft's very own Chuck Norris's Mancrick, who's lost his wife in a battle, and you have to go and find the corpse of his wife.
He is an angry man.
He is an angry, angry man. I think they've said that in Cataclysm he might actually... finally have figured out after millions, 11 million people plus, if you think that everyone's got more than one alt, 11 million people have probably told Mancrick, your wife is over here, she is dead, let it go.
Yeah, sorry mate, she's gone.
And he's still not learning. So hopefully he'll sling his hook in Cataclysm.
That's but, very unsympathetic.
I know
it is. The poor man has lost his wife.
Yeah, I lost the immersion there for a second, didn't I, really? How many times has Silvana sung that song? She probably goes, this necklace, again. Do you know how many times I've had to, come on, backing singers, off you get. No.
And yeah. Actually, you know, now that you referenced her backing singers earlier on, now all I'm seeing is Diana Ross and the Supremes.
Well, that's what they look like. They do, well, maybe dragged through a hedge backwards, maybe. But yeah, that's, the Sylvanas and their backing singers is what happened to Diana Ross and the Supremes when Arthur's caught up with them. But, right, finally talking about the quests in the Barrens. The thing I mentioned before, the really surprising quest I'd never done. As you're leaving the Barrens out towards Stone Talon, which is where we were going, we were packing up our bags and ready to move on to our next zone. You run past a little horde camp, and there's a quest giver there, and he sends you to kill various leaders of the centaurs at the oases around the Barrens. And we thought, well, we might as well do this, check out all the oases and stuff. So we did. And the final quest in this chain is you have to go outside and defend the horde encampment from an attack by the final centaur leader and a bunch of his men. And the thing, the biggest impression I got about it, because it's a kind of scripted event, you go outside, wait for these things to happen. And obviously these happen in the game all the time, but it's on quite a big scale for that level. And it's tough. You know, we found it hard, just the two of us. If you were soloing it, I think you'd find it very tough. But the biggest kind of impression I got from that zone, from that quest rather, was this really in the game from vanilla? Because it feels like it's that kind of dynamic, interesting questing they've put in since. And it was a great way to cap off our time in the Crossroads, really exciting kind of denouement.
Yeah. And it may actually not have, I mean, I know for a fact I've done it before on other characters, but maybe it wasn't in there right from the outset. But yeah, it's a little set piece, and it kind of, it does cap that sequence of quests really nicely, and it, as you say, it does serve as a kind of nice tail end as you head west, working out the compass there, as you head west out of the Barrens into Stone Talon. Before we wrap up on the Barrens completely, there is one landmark that we should probably mention, just because it's, you know, it's got significance both in the game and for AIE, is the Shrine of the Fallen Warrior, which is on one of the hills near the Crossroads. The story of it I won't go into here, but please do WoW Wiki it or WoW Head it, and you'll see the background to why it's there in the game. But it's also, from an Alia Iacta Est point of view, it's where traditionally the memorial for Milliway has started each of the last few years. And so from that point of view, it's somewhere that a lot of us are very familiar with for a very specific and very important reason. So as a landmark in the Barrens, worth checking out. If you are a member of AIE listening to this, it's probably something that you'll be familiar with anyway.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing you can't imagine them taking out as well. So I think that'll be around until they switch the servers off. And finally, for this bit of the show, we've got Crashing back again, who's taking a look at one of the instances around these levels, and he's taking a look this time at the Wailing Caverns.
Today we're going to be taking a quick peek at an instance located in the heart of the Barrens, the Wailing Caverns. Like the last instance we talked about, Ragefire Chasm, Wailing Caverns is the cave system. That's where the similarities end, however. Unlike Ragefire, Wailing Caverns provides players with a complex and interesting series of challenges in a colorful and engaging environment. It's not boring all red rocks and the same mobs over and over again. The portal to this instance is found deep in a cave in the Lushwater Oasis, one of the pockets of green that are dotted about the Barrens. The story associated with the dungeon, why it is where it is, and why it is how it is important not only to the current iteration of the game, but also as it relates to the upcoming changes in Cataclysm. That's because the story of the Wailing Caverns is really the story of the Night Elf Druid Narlex. Narlex had made it his personal mission to return the Barrens back to its previous green and verdant state. His plan was to use the Wailing Caverns to bring this change about. Unfortunately, when he connected to the Emerald Dream and tried to put his plan into motion, things, as things often seem to do, went awry. Narlex was unable to wake up, and the caverns were transformed into a nightmare-like dream state. With their boss asleep, Narlex's disciples were also corrupted, and now are the primary antagonists in the dungeon. It's the job of the players to wake the druid from his coma. The cave system itself is full of a variety of flora. An underground stream runs through much of the dungeon, and there are varying pockets of plant life throughout to keep the entrance from falling into the boring, dank cave category and make it a place worth exploring. The fauna is pleasantly diverse as well. Besides the legions of corrupted druids, players will face off against a variety of enemies including raptors, crocolisks, bog beasts, snakes of all shapes and sizes, and even a murloc, supporting the theory that nothing was ever made worse by the inclusion of a murloc. In their task to wake up Narlex, players will encounter, probably for the first time, what I refer to as the if-then mechanic, which will then be a staple of instances to come. Rather than a straightforward romp where you start at the instance entrance and fight your way to the back, players who want to properly complete the dungeon will have to perform a series of triggering events. This is a standard instance and raid mechanic, and in this case the triggering event is the killing of the four Fang Lords, the most powerful of the corrupted druids. Killing the Fang Lords will allow the players to start the end of dungeon event, during which an uncorrupted disciple of Narlex will travel, accompanied by the players, through the dungeon and start the ritual which will wake the sleeping druid leader. The final boss in this event is a gigantic murloc named Mutanus the Devourer. Kill him and Narlex will finally wake up, feeling refreshed and in desperate need of a toothbrush and something to eat. With a good group, Wailing Caverns is a lot of fun. It's a large dungeon, so you have to set aside a bit of time for it, and the layout is complex enough to be a bit confusing for first-timers, so be aware of that. The 9 bosses are sufficiently challenging and drop pretty good loot for the level. Players should be aware that the monsters at the beginning will respawn, so if you go in without someone who can res and players get killed, or if, God forbid, the healer gets killed, the rest of the party will have to travel back and get them when they re-enter. The instance is important as it relates to Cataclysm, because with the expansion comes big changes to the Barrens, changes that seem to be a direct result of Narlex's efforts. It'll be interesting to see if there are any changes to the storyline of Wailing Cavern that goes along with this. That's it for Wailing Caverns. Next time we'll take a look at one of the dungeons slated for big changes with Cataclysm.
Okay, that wraps up the Barrens, and now it's time for a look at another one of the Horde cities. In this show, we're going to be looking at the undead capital, Undercity.
Now, we did, it has to be said, have a certain amount of discussion last time round about Undercity as a kind of fallout from talking about Orgrimmar. So we probably shouldn't get too much into more of it this time. But I think, you know, as we established last time, we find Undercity quite frustrating. It's not by any means as bad as it could be. It's got a lot going for it, and there are some very important features of the city as far as the lore and, you know, being part of the Horde is concerned. But it is that whole running around, never quite being quite sure which one of the various quarters you're in and whether you should be on the inner circle or the outer circle, and how come when you turn out of a doorway and turn left you think you're going one way and you think you're actually going the other. I think all of that stuff that we touched on last time remains valid as far as our observations of Undercity are concerned this time round. There are a couple of things that I think, you know, we should point out. One is obviously, and we already discussed it fairly extensively earlier, Sylvanas's throne room is in Undercity, and it's definitely worth checking out. And that, as we said earlier, if you happen to time it right, you can catch her doing one of her Diana Ross performances. One of the things I think is really interesting about Undercity, and it was mentioned by Thyatira in his comments, is up on the ground level on the way out, they're in the main courtyard. Although you can't normally see it, the whole place is populated by ghosts. And if you have anything on you that will allow you to see them, you know, detect invisibility, stuff like that, you'll find yourself walking through a space that is just teeming with the ghosts of former citizens. And that's just one of those really nice little touches that most people will probably never see. But I really like that Blizzard threw that into the game as a little detail.
On a similar note, something you can't normally hear is in the old throne room in the ruins above the city. If you stop and you turn up, I think it's your ambient sounds all the way, and turn everything else down and turn your volume up loud, you can hear the ghostly echoes of the confrontation between Arthas and his father when he became the Lich King, which is a fantastic bit of atmosphere, just kind of hidden away there. There's a lot that's interesting about Undercity, but I think when it comes down to it, it is the least appealing, the least interesting of the Horde cities. It's quite well laid out once you get the hang of it. Particularly since they put a few more mailboxes in it, it's a reasonable place to leave a bank alt or something. But it's, and there's lots of quests there, so there's lots of reasons to be there. but not a lot of reasons to stay there.
Yeah. And just one very little detail that I discovered relatively recently, not specifically as part of this project, but I did go back just to make sure I wasn't misremembering it. Again, in the rooms above the city, in the space where you can hear that the ghostly echo of that exchange, there is a little plaque that says, you know, this is the final resting place of King Menethil. And, you know, again, it's one of those little details that ties into the lore, makes it clear that, you know, the city of Lordaeron, as it used to be, was a fundamentally important part in the very, very big story that Wrath of the Lich King has kind of is wrapping up. So yeah, it's a place that's important for its historical reasons, and it's a place that's important because of it being the headquarters of the Forsaken. But you're right, it's not a place that has a great deal else going for it in and of itself these days. No. Though obviously, it's going to change.
Yeah, it's one of the things that it is changing in Cataclysm. I think it's unclear at this point how much the actual undercity is going to change, but the ruins of Lordaeron are certainly going to be different.
Yeah.
so that'll be interesting. And of course, it's changed a lot already anyway in the game. With in the Wrath of the Lich King, there is the very famous Wrathgate questline, which eventually sends you back to Undercity, where you have a big battle to retake it from Varimathras's forces and all the evil undead people who are basically trying to kill everybody.
The slightly more evil undead.
Yes. that's great. I mean, it's an epic quest to take part in. It uses the phasing aspects of Wrath of the Lich King really well. Now we're some months after that, and most people have gone through the Wrathgate quests. There are permanent changes we've seen in the city. The Abomination Guards have gone, and they've been replaced by orcs. Varimathras has gone. So it's already changed a bit. But even with all that, it still doesn't grab me. There's something quite iconic about Orgrimmar. There's nothing that grabs you, you know, gets you in the gut about Undercity.
No.
It's not an easy city to love.
I would agree with that. The one little detail that Warrak mentioned, and I do completely agree with, that's pretty cool about Orgrimmar, about Undercity, is that the flight out of there is fantastic, because when you get on the flight path, the first part of it, you're flying out through the sewers. So as he points out, flying underground is pretty damn cool.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Now, before we start wrapping up the show, we've got one of our regular looks at the Alliance side of things around this level from Baera, who this time is taking a look at the history and the questing in Westfall.
Hello there. You look like a young adventurer who's eager to champion a noble cause. But I wonder how noble you'll feel when your masters send you to slaughter entire centaur villages or torture prisoners. Is all this really worth a little gold and some grudging respect? Aren't you tired of being everyone's errand boy? If you're looking for better terms and more gainful employment, you might find inspiration in Westfall. Once the breadbasket of Azeroth, Westfall's land and people never recovered from the orc invasion of the First War. Perhaps if the nobles of Stormwind had acted differently, this region might have flourished once again. Consider the city of Stormwind today. Walk along its bustling harbor front, or rest yourself in the park or the Cathedral of Light. Shop till you drop, then revive yourself in one of the taverns. Marvel at the white, sun-kissed walls, and try to imagine what it took to rebuild such a city from the ashes. When King Varian led his people back to Stormwind, stonemasons, tinkers, and artisans of all kinds stepped forward, contributing months and years of labor to rebuilding the city. But once the walls rose and the city's defenses were complete, the House of Nobles refused to pay those whose craft, strength, and resourcefulness had made all this possible. They tried to bribe the leaders of the Stonemasons Guild to look the other way, but Edwin Van Cleef refused to trade the welfare of his colleagues for a cushy government job. Riots broke out, and people died. The nobles exiled Van Cleef and his compatriots from the city, but Van Cleef organized the craftsmen into the Defias Brotherhood. He welcomed those from any race or faction whose discontent made them sympathetic to his cause. What have the Defias accomplished? admittedly not much beyond general banditry and some jail riots. But they've kept free of Stormwind's control, and they haven't given up. Mostly dislodged from Elwyn Forest, the Defias have made neighboring Westfall their home. Largely abandoned after the war, Westfall provided a bandit's paradise with plenty of hideouts and access to the sea. Most of the farms have been left to the mercy of wild boar, coyote, and rogue mechanical devices called harvest watchers. Nevertheless, a couple of farmers still tried to make a go of it, despite the long odds they face. Stop by Farmer Saldean's place, where a little work will earn you a bowl of Westfall stew. And if you're willing to do the chicken dance, you can even walk away with one of his prize Westfall hens. Further down the road, you'll find Sentinel Hill, where a token alliance force guards the tower, leaving much of the defense work to a ragtag band that call themselves the People's Militia. But venture off the road, and I admonish you to tread carefully, because you're in Defias territory. If you walk in the footsteps of the Defias messenger, and if you're unlucky while questing, you could do a lot of that, you'll see Defias patrolling every farmstead and lying in wait to ambush soldiers or traveling merchants. You can find their base of operations in the abandoned town of Moonbrook, well, under it, really. Down in the serpentine network of tunnels that make up the dead mines, the Defias have employed gnolls, goblins, and pirates to mine, make weapons, and smuggle goods. They've even got a murloc cook named Cookie. And if you happen to speak McGurgle-urgle, I'll bet he has a good story to tell. The mines end in a hidden cove that the Defias have closed off from the sea with a pair of massive doors. From there, they can launch ships that prey on Stormwind's merchant vessels or communicate with the Bloodsail Buccaneers of Stranglethorn. And if you've survived the journey this far, prepare to meet Edwin Van Cleef himself. Yes, I know they all say that Van Cleef died long ago. Let's just say he tends to lose his head on a regular basis. When you finally exit the dead mines, you'll find yourself a little ways west of Moonbrook. From there, you can head east into the treacherous Dagger Hills. If you hazard that route, be sure to have a chat with a rather befuddled Grimbooze Thunderbrew, who serves up beer with poetry, which, let's face it, really should happen more in life. Alternatively, you can follow the coast north. At the Westfall Lighthouse, the ghost of Captain Grayson will regale you with his tale of shipwreck and send you up and down Longshore to battle with murlocs and find lost treasure. All along the coast, you'll see the wrecks of mighty elven destroyers from the Second War, and once again, you'll be reminded of the conflicts that have plagued this land. Many say that the Defias are merely brutal bandits and opportunists following Van Cleef's mad schemes. But have the Alliance or the Horde done any better or worse with their constant fighting? Perhaps, with all you've seen here, you'll find yourself wondering whether Edwin Van Cleef wasn't right after all.
Thank you very much, Bayera. There's really not a lot to say after that. That was a pretty comprehensive and brilliant look at the zone. Certainly in our Alliance days, we spent a lot of time in that zone. It remains one of my favourites. It's pretty, it's varied to a degree. It's fun, you know, mechanical scarecrows out of control. It's a good zone. It's definitely a good zone.
I remember those mechanical scarecrows out of control being pretty tough as well at level. You know, they were one of the things that I really, really remember about that zone in my early Alliance days. Those things were hit hard.
Yep. And then there's the Dead Mines, which remains one of the best instances in the game. I'm really glad that's going to be heroicized at 85 and we get to go there again. And, it's fun. It's a really, really fun little place. And that was a brilliant... The history of the Defias and their connection to Stormwind and all the history there is really interesting. And that was a great little summation there from Bayera.
Yeah. And the fact that the Defias are kind of all over Westfall and you know, they really feel like a presence, I think is really cool there too.
Yeah. So that basically brings episode 3 to a close. Thank you very much for listening.
Doesn't the time fly? Next time, we're going to be having an all Kalimdor special. We're going to be in Stone Talon. We're going to be in Ashen Vale and Thousand Needles. So we're going to be checking out all those bits in the middle of Kalimdor. Please don't forget to give us your thoughts, suggestions, ideas, recommendations on the thread that's going to be up in the forums relating to show 4.
Yep, the episode 4 thread will be up now. And if you're listening to the enhanced version of the podcast, there's a link to it right now on your screen. Please let us know about these zones. We know that at least two of them are going to change significantly. We saw a screenshot of something in Ashenvale, which made us giggle a lot.
It did.
So yeah, these ones are going to be very significantly changed. So they're quite significant to the whole project.
Yeah, and this is where the Barons started the journey. This is us really getting out into seriously contested territory now, especially Ashenvale. I'm really looking forward to getting into that one again and exploring it from this point of view.
Yep, I think that's the key thing. With this episode, more than episodes 1 and 2, the world is beginning to broaden. There's more to talk about. The zones are designed for you to be spending more time in them, so there is more to do there. There is more to see, and it's becoming more exciting. Plus, we're hitting things, like I said, that are going to change significantly. So it's quite thrilling to be cataloguing these things, saying this is how it is today, but not how it will be in a few months' time.
Yeah, and I think as we get closer, we're going to get more of a sense of how much things are going to change, and I think it's actually going to be quite a lot more than even certainly than I was expecting. So it is great to be able to really get under the skin of all these places one last time, and hopefully be able to point out a few places that you didn't know about either.
Definitely. So, yeah, once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to contribute, you can hop on the forum thread and let us know your thoughts about the zone and about the show. If you want to email us, you can get us at postcards@aie-guild.org, where you can also send us little sound files about your favourite things about the zones we'll be talking about.
And apart from that, I think we're kind of good to go.
Yep, that's it. We'll see you in just over a week's time with episode 4. Goodbye.
Goodbye.